The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. I'm going to start out today reading from the Trivial Pursuits section. Battle of Wills Works Miracle. Patty Duke and Anne Bancroft played Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan, respectively, in William Gibson's 1959 The Miracle Worker on Broadway. The Tony Award winner, based on Keller's life, was made into a film in 1962, with the actresses recreating their roles as student and teacher. Arthur Penn directed both the Broadway play and the film. The Miracle Worker shows a young Helen cut off since infancy from the world around her. Blind and deaf from an illness, the exceptionally bright child wreaks havoc on her family with frequent outbursts. As a last resort before sending her to an asylum, her parents turn for help to Boston's highly respected Perkins Institute for the Blind. The school sends a recent graduate, 20-year-old Annie Sullivan, to the Keller's Alabama home. A battle of wills arises after the two meet, with Annie making measured progress through skill, persistence, and brute strength in her attempts to reach the unhappy child. One harrowing scene involves a 9-minute ordeal in which Annie is determined to force her recalcitrant charge to behave properly at the table. Annie seems to approach Helen as a wild colt, to be tamed, and when the teacher gains the upper hand in the intense struggle, the dynamic changes. Helen finally accepts the teacher's efforts to introduce her to language. The story plays out much like a familiar Western. A heroic stranger arrives to tackle an overwhelming problem. In real life, Anne and Helen would continue to live and work together. The Miracle Worker was nominated for 5 Academy Awards. Oscars went to Bancroft for Best Actress and to Duke for Best Supporting Actress. And now, here's Johnny. Timeless humor, snappy suits, that signature golf swing, all belong to Johnny Carson, who started his 30-year gig hosting NBC's The Tonight Show on October 2, 1962. Which of these highlights can you dial up? Carson's moniker as a young magician playing the local Kiwanis Club in Norfolk, Nebraska. Do you know what name he went by? The Great Carsoni. Carson took over the show from this host. It was Jack Parr. Do you know the leader of the Tonight Show's band from 1967 to 92? That was Doc Severson. More than 45 million viewers watched this guest wedding to Miss Vicky in 1969. Do you know who that was? Tiny Tim. The talk show host wears a feather turban to play this all-knowing seer. Do you know who that was? Karnak the Magnificent. These exotic animal experts bring alligators, gorillas, and marmosets on the show. That was Joan Embry and Jim Fowler. A gray wig and wire-rimmed glasses transform Carson into this cranky older woman. What was her name? Aunt Blabby. The Tonight Show's most frequent guest, he appears more than 131 times. Do you know who that guest is? It's Bob Hope. And lastly, when a monologue joke fails, Carson pulls down the boom mic and says this. Do you remember what that was? Attention, Kmart shoppers! Buckle up. Niles Boland designed ejection seats before he became a safety engineer for Swedish automaker Volvo. There, Boland designed a restraint that held the upper body in place during a crash, making it far safer than just a lap belt. Volvo patented the design in 1962, and that year the term buckle up came into common use. In an act of generosity, Volvo opened up the patent so other automakers could add the safety measure. The company is satisfied with taking the credit, thus the proud slogan, "There's a little bit of Volvo in every car." And from the Spotlight section, we have a brief article on Burt Reynolds, who lived from 1936 to 2018. Oozing charm and manly charisma, Burt Reynolds knocked around in TV bit parts for almost a decade until in 1962 he landed the role of Quint Asper on the CBS Western Gunsmoke. Reynolds played a mixed-race blacksmith who becomes deputy to Marshal Matt Dillon. He left in 1965, taking his gruff good looks to the movies. Indeed, despite some critically acclaimed roles, Reynolds is best remembered as the good old boy action star of the 1970s Smokey and the Bandit movies. He was a Southerner by choice, not by birth. He was born Burton Leon Reynolds Jr. in Lansing, Michigan, and raised in Riviera Beach, Florida. For years, he claimed to have been born in Waycross, Georgia, but in his 2015 memoir, he admitted that he made it up to deny his northern roots. "I didn't want to be a Yankee." He went to Florida State on a football scholarship. Known as Buddy to distinguish him from his father, Reynolds was a star player at Palm Beach High School and much sought after by college teams, eventually joining the FSU Seminoles as a running back. But knee troubles and a car crash finally forced him to quit the sport. He remained an FSU booster for the rest of his life. He was part Cherokee. Reynolds' tribal heritage was often a factor that landed him roles in the early days of his career. He used to joke that the only indigenous character he never was asked to play was Pocahontas. About that nude Cosmo spread. Around the time of his breakthrough film role as Lewis Medlock in Deliverance, he broke an unspoken cultural barrier by posing nude for Cosmopolitan. He rued it later, believing it hurt his standing as an actor. He regretted the one that got away. Though twice divorced from Judy Carne and Lonnie Anderson, his romances were mostly long-term, especially with Dinah Shore and Sally Field. He called Field the love of my life and wished he'd married her. Burt Reynolds is quoted as saying, "I may not be the best actor in the world, but I'm the best Burt Reynolds in the world." Our next article is submitted by Alexander Carson of Magnolia, Delaware, and it's titled, "Blinded by Science. Chemistry nerds were in their element until they got an unexpected reaction." As teenagers, my friend Peter and I spent our time experimenting and tinkering. Peter's father was a top chemist for Mobil, making Peter a natural partner when we started our own chemical laboratory in 1963. Every weekend, we took the bus to Arthur H. Thomas Company to buy laboratory equipment in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Using tips earned from delivering newspapers, we acquired beakers, test tubes, and a Bunsen burner, and soon we had a well-equipped chemistry lab, equal to the one in our high school, at least. All we needed were some chemicals for our experiments. With an ink pad and lettering stamp, we used some of my father's stationery to make letterhead for Carpet, a combination of my last name, Carson, and Peter's name, Chemical Laboratories, listing my home address in Woodbury, New Jersey. Every day during our school lunch hour, we wrote letters to chemical companies we'd found in professional journals and industry publications. We contacted Allied Chemical, Rahm and Haas Chemicals, Dow, Hercules, and DuPont, requesting carbon, sulfur, nitric acid, potassium, and anything else we could get for free. Some of these were relatively safe, but others were downright hazardous. 2 weeks passed, and we were surprised to see a Mack truck on our street breaking off tree limbs and avoiding parked cars as it approached my house. The 6-pound shipment from Armor Industrial Chemical Company was labeled Fragile Liquid. More shipments arrived, some by mail, all marked with warning labels. School ended, and we went swimming most days, so some shipments were dropped at the neighbor's. My mother was pleased Peter and I were doing something educational, but the neighbors looked suspiciously at the hazard labels when they brought the boxes over. One day, while my father was at work, he got a call from the FBI. Peter and I had requested a free sample of a rocket fuel from Rahm and Haas in Philadelphia, unaware that it was a top-secret formulation for the federal government. Fortunately, the FBI deemed us not to be a threat and took no further action on our case. Dad was furious and told Peter's family about our pastime. Carpet Chemical Labs was forced out of business, and Peter and I had to dismantle the lab. Rather than letting all those chemicals go to waste, Peter and I tried to make one last concoction, urea formaldehyde resin, which we'd heard about from Peter's dad. In our basement lab, we combined the chemicals, with all going well until a thick white cloud of noxious smoke erupted from the Florence flask we were heating. The irritating chemical fumes drove everyone out of the house, including my mother. Luckily, no one was injured, but the fumes lingering, my mother ordered us to dig a hole in the backyard and throw all the chemicals in, ending our experiment for good. I don't know if Peter had a career that involved chemistry. I worked in law enforcement, but I'm grateful for that time we had to busy ourselves with teenage experimentation gone a little haywire. And from the True Love section, Doris Hoffman of Wheatland, Wyoming, submits an article titled, Soldier Gets Home Ahead of His Mail. My parents, the Walters, lived across the street from Roy and Pat Hoffman in the mid-1940s. Roy's brother, William Richard, called Dick by everyone, was in the Army and home on furlough. One day, Dick's niece crossed the street to tell me that her uncle wanted to meet me. I told her that he should come over himself if he wanted to meet me. The girl came back a few more times, and the last time she grabbed my shoe and took it with her. Soon Dick and Pat, his sister-in-law, brought my shoe back, and that's how I met him. He invited me for ice cream. I said, no thank you, but while I was sitting on the porch later, he came back again. He had only 3 days left on leave, and we began dating. Dick was in paratrooper training, and he came home once more before he was sent overseas to Germany. We got engaged while he was home, and then he was gone for a year. During that time, I stopped writing him, and eventually I sent him a Dear John letter to end the relationship. In 1946, on the day he was coming home, I was waiting tables at a local cafe. I was worried about the letter I'd sent, but when he came into the restaurant and I saw his boots, I fell in love all over again. We were married 2 weeks later, on March 3, 1946. A couple of weeks after our wedding, the Dear John letter arrived. Dick told me that if he'd known about the letter, he would have gone to Tijuana instead of coming home. Dick and I were married for 72 years. We adopted a boy, Larry, and I now have grandchildren and great-granddaughter. Dick died in 2018, and I miss him. He was a great husband, father, grandfather, and friend. And it all started with a shoe. From At Work section, we have an article titled, He Learned the Rewards of Loyalty, and this is submitted by Charles Satchter of Moline, Illinois. The clerk who answered the phone at Erickson's Quality Store in Viola, Illinois, always stretched out the name, Quality. This impressed on callers that they'd reached the store that sold only high-quality items such as Del Monte, Monarch, and Libby's canned goods that were difficult to get during World War II. Mr. Erickson was a terrific salesman. Shoppers rarely turned him down when he suggested they should really try something. The customer was king, or queen, mostly. Besides Mr. Erickson and me, his wife Dorothy and Loretta Esp waited on customers. Shoppers read their list to us, and we gathered items one at a time. No supermarket efficiency for us. Although wartime shortages were a constant theme, most people didn't complain, knowing soldiers had it so much worse. Our shelves were partly empty at times, but no one went away empty-handed. We made sure our loyal customers were taken care of, even when items were scarce. I was only 13, yet I learned to tell white lies. With a straight face, I tell a shopper, "No, we don't have any black pepper," adding to myself, "for you, because you're not a regular customer." But for a regular, Loretta would whisper, "Put 3 bananas in a sack for her." She often told me, "If you do this for me, I'll dance at your wedding." My main job was stocking shelves, but I could do every job in the store except cut steak. My least favorite job was cleaning the meat display cabinet. I had to climb inside with a bucket of hot, soapy water. I was sure I looked silly inside the cabinet. Beef was in very short supply during those war years, and so Mr. Erickson developed a system. It started with an order of canned goods from Herman Grimmel in Muscatine, Iowa. Since Mr. Erickson was a good customer, Mr. Grimmel also let him have a case of cigarettes. The cigarettes were rationed out to our regulars, 2 packs a week. But Mr. Erickson also used a few cartons to close the deal on a side of beef, obtained from a mysterious supplier in Davenport, Iowa. He'd spend much of Friday night cutting and wrapping the meat orders, which he would mark with a family name and the amount owed. I worked at Erickson's from 8th grade until I graduated from high school. The experience helped me get hired at IBM after I graduated from college. The next article I want to share with you is from Our Heroes section, and it is submitted by Patrick Hartigan of Torrance, California, and it's titled, "Solo Performance and Home Theater Entertained the Entire Family." During the Depression, ours was one of the many poor families living in Chicago, Illinois. There wasn't enough money for everyone to go to a movie, so my clever brothers and sisters saved their pennies to send the oldest, Jack, to the theater. He'd watch the movie, sometimes more than once, memorizing the storyline and as much of the dialogue as he could. When he came home, my 8 siblings sat as if they were in a movie theater, and Jack would begin movie night. Jim might act a part, or if Jack needed a stunt person, Terry. My sisters Vernon and Rose sometimes played female roles. Most of the time, Jack acted out everything by himself so that the family could sit back and enjoy the show. He ran, climbed, and fell, and had sword fights, fist fights, and arguments. His villains brought to mind the biggest, meanest guys. His heroes and heroines were the handsomest and most beautiful Jack's audience could imagine. The show was funnier, scarier, and more exciting for taking place in the minds of my brothers and sisters. When the movie ended, his audience wanted more. "Play the movie again, Jack." And Jack, being the trooper that he was, would start over with a second showing. Back then, movies opened with a newsreel and then a cartoon. Jack skipped those parts. Only Mel Blanc could do a cartoon properly, and the news of the day wasn't very good. I know about this family entertainment from the stories my siblings told me. I wasn't born until 1942, and Jack went off to fight in World War II, where he died in combat when I was only 2. I'm sure Jack's movies were much better than the ones shown in the theater, and I'd give anything to have been in attendance, even as an usher. I'd love to be able to tell a story the way Jack did, although I'm not sure my children or grandchildren would be all that thrilled to hear my movie renditions. Sometimes when I'm watching a movie that isn't very good, I think of Jack and wonder how he would have acted it out. Allie Kuhman submits an article to the Family Tree section titled, "Pop Provides Home for Kids in Need." My grandmother, Christina, didn't talk much about her childhood. Her father died when she was a child, and her mother, Flora, married Percy Curry, whom Christina called Pop. The marriage didn't last. Flora abandoned Christina and her siblings and married and moved several times, making Flora difficult to trace through the census. But I found Christina and her brother Roscoe in the 1920 census. They lived with Pop and his new wife Annie in Lamont, Illinois. I fell in love with this man who took these children into his home when Flora skipped out. I found two newspaper articles from 1928. The first said that Pop was shot by an estranged husband in April of that year. The second, from May, reported that the man who shot Pop was acquitted. This explained my grandmother's silence on her past. Her biological father died when she was four, then her mother abandoned her. Later, the man she considered to be a father was killed. Grandma Christina's story gets better. The 1930 census lists her in Bedford, Indiana, with her half-sister, Laura, who was married with a son. Not long after, Christina met Frank Statton, and they married in 1932. My father was born a few years later. I also found Flora. She married her fifth husband in 1929. She died that year, age 52, and is buried in Terre Haute, Indiana. At the top of her small headstone is the word mother. And as a supplement to this article, we have some information about creating a timeline. Grandparents can be reluctant to go into detail about the past, sometimes just dropping tidbits of information. Our submitter did an excellent job piecing together clues and using multiple sources so that young Christina's fascinating story emerged. Female ancestors can be a challenge to research. Consider creating a timeline for each ancestor and work on filling in the gaps. Here are a few ways to begin. 1. Create a timeline with dates you have and then work on identifying the rest. 2. For married women, look for records using the surname of their husband. 3. For unmarried and young women, search using the surname of their father. Search death records and wills, census records and records of marriages, divorces, and children's births. Note the subject's age at each event. Consider doing a timeline of your own life, too. Here are some resources. FamilySearch.org/wiki, and that is spelled W-I-K-I. Again, FamilySearch.org/wiki. And another resource, OurTimelines.com. My next article is from a section called Letter Perfect. Family correspondence captures the magic of everyday life in the voices of those we love. And this article is submitted by Anita Johnson of Silverdale, Washington. My dad, Norman Porch, left home at age 19 when he was drafted to serve in World War II. He never returned after the war because he and my mother, Dixie, settled in Bremerton, Washington. But their hometown of Anita, Iowa, was always back home to them, and yes, I am named after their hometown. For years afterward, Dad often sat at the kitchen table to write letters to family members back in Iowa, always in his perfect Palmer Method script. Recently, my cousin found one of Dad's letters among her late mother's belongings. Her mom, Patty Stockham, was one of my dad's four sisters, and she lived near Anita her entire life. Patty's letter from Dad was a round-robin letter from September 15, 1959, and read by several members of the family. Dad wrote it shortly after we moved into the house that became our family home for 55 years. It gives me insight into what was going on at that point in time when I was just 9 months old. It is mostly about typical events in their lives. Mom went to the PTA meeting at school. My sisters Cindy and Diane liked their schools and their teachers. And Dad took a trip with my grandfather to Yakima and the Columbia River Valley, where they bought some peaches for 89 cents per box. Toward the end of the letter, however, he had some startling news. The way it looks at present, I may have the rare experience of losing my job, he wrote. Dad was a civilian worker at the former Keyport Naval Torpedo Station, which overhauled and repaired torpedoes. He explained that the Department of Defense was putting more and more emphasis on missiles, and about 40 workers were expected to be cut. I never knew that my father was once in danger of being laid off from work. Fortunately, it never happened. The sweetest part of the letter is about me. He wrote, "At this hour, I am attempting to get Anita Jane to go to sleep. She has a head cold, so is real fussy. She is normally a real easy baby to care for." This letter is precious to me, reminding me that my dad cherished his family connections and continued to miss his family in Iowa long after leaving home at such a young age. And I have another article from the Letter Perfect section, and this is submitted by Glenda Ferguson of Powley, Indiana, and it's titled "Lifeline Via the Post Office Box." When I left for college of the Ozarks in 1972, it was the first time I had ever been away from home. Even though it was only a four-hour drive to my family in Chamois, Missouri, I was homesick. Our dormitory didn't have phones in the rooms. Communication from family came to me at Post Office Box 469, Point Lookout, Missouri. I would receive letters, cards, and occasionally a pink slip that told me I had a package too large to fit in the mailbox. The post office became an important link to my family. Not only did I get letters from Mom and Dad, I received letters from my grandmothers, aunts, cousins, and later from my brother in the military. I always wrote a letter back. It's a wonder I had any time to attend classes and study. My grandmother, Cora Walker, would write every week describing everyday events and saying that it must make for boring reading. Those are the very things I treasure when I reread her letters now. My grandfather, Henry, wasn't much for writing. He left that to my grandmother, but he did like to draw. When I wrote to them about a tennis tournament I had entered, my grandfather already decided the outcome. He sent me a drawing of me winning. In fact, I did win. My grandparents would send me $5 or $10 for birthdays or just in case I needed spending money. I could always tell when their letter had cash inside because the bill was wrapped in foil. I suppose they were trying to foil anyone else trying to see through the envelope. I saved every letter I received. Later, I learned that my mother and grandmother did the same with my letters to them. I have 4 years' worth of saved letters in binders. Together, they form a time capsule of my college years. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reminisce is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And that number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.